The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Coming up later on today's show, we'll talk about the Holocaust Memorial Day commemorations that were going on in Auschwitz yesterday. We'll talk about some of the events that have been going on recently in the Middle East. As usual, there's a whole lot happening with Iran and Israel and others over there. But I'll start on a bit of a lighter note. We have a new coin coming to the UK. It says peace, prosperity, and friendship with all nations. That's a quote taken or adapted a little from Thomas Jefferson. And it's causing a lot of people to have an absolute fit. Now, you know, what's so bad about peace, prosperity, and friendship with all nations? Well, the coin has been minted to commemorate Brexit Day. And so Remainers, or Ramonas as they've been christened in the press, are hopping mad. We had a coin commemorating Britain coming into the EU back in the 70s, but apparently having a coin for leaving the EU is beyond the pale. Britain, that big day, that Brexit day, or the day that we officially leave the European Union, is coming up at the end of the week, January 31st. I think it's 11 p.m. we'll officially leave the European Union. And it's been, I mean, you still see the resistance to Britain leaving the European Union just in the way that that day is treated. You know, going back to that coin, people have been saying, oh, well, we're not going to accept these. If a shopkeeper tries to give me this 50 pence piece that says peace, prosperity, and friendship, well, you know, I won't take it. And I'll ask for two 20s and a 10 instead. Or some others have been saying, I'm just going to throw them away. There's been others that are saying, well, I'll give them to beggars. I'll save them all up and I'll give them to beggars. But, you know, you see this, like I said, you see this with the whole celebration for when it comes to Brexit. You know, there was this big push to have Big Ben bong for Brexit, to have that bell ring when Britain leaves the European Union, because currently the clock tower there by the Houses of Parliament is under refurbishment. It's not working. But for special occasions like the New Year, they have the bell sound. And so they said, well, can we have it sound to mark Britain's independence of the European Union? And they were told, no, it's going to cost £500,000 to make that sound. I don't know how they came up with the figure of £500,000 to ring a bell. But they're not doing that. They said no to fireworks for then, because apparently that might wake up nesting birds. Again, fireworks are fine for New Year's Day. At midnight, but 11 p.m. on Brexit Day, on January 31st, you might wake up the birds. So a whole lot of sore losers on that front. And it shows that they're going to fight this hard about just about celebrations or about a coin. There is a division in the UK that isn't going away. You know, I think there's good news for Britain leaving the European Union. There's a lot to be excited about on that, but that opposition isn't going anywhere, and that division is just going to stick around, just like we see in the States. But a solution, if you do find yourself ideologically opposed to these 50 pence pieces, I have a solution for you. Stick them in an envelope, address them to P.O. Box 16945, Henley and Arden, B95 8BH. And we will take care of those for you here at the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Practical solution for that everyday problem. Now, like I mentioned, lots of news still coming out of the Middle East. We had more missiles launched over the weekend against the US embassy in Iraq. This time they actually hit the embassy. I think they've been trying for some time, and these are missiles launched, I think, not directly from Iran, but from military proxy groups still backed by Iran. But the missiles, I guess, they're a little less sophisticated than some of those other ones. And they hit. I think they've tried to hit the U.S. embassy several times. They actually succeeded this time. Meanwhile, you've got more protests over there. Amnesty International puts the total deaths of the protests in Iraq at 600 since October. And this really is it's probably the last fight back from Iraq as Iran takes over, and you know, the people there, they're starting to realize this is how far we've come. This is how much Iran has taken over. If we're going to gain our independence, we're going to have to fight for it, and we're going to have to fight for it before it's too late. But I think it already is too late, but there's still that pushback coming there. Then you've also got Iran preparing to send a missile or a satellite into space, calling it a missile. They had three failed attempts last year at launching a satellite. Sorry, they're calling it a satellite. I mean, really, the technology to send a satellite up into space and the technology to send a ballistic missile into on its way to hit a target is pretty much the same thing. You know, a ballistic missile, intercontinental ballistic missile, goes up into space and then comes down again. The satellite just goes up into space, but fundamentally, the technology to launch a satellite and to launch an ICBM are the same. So you can see them still moving forward with that nuclear program. You know, still, despite the pressure Mr. Trump is putting them under, they're still working hard towards that. San Francisco Planet Labs, they released satellite imagery showing all of this activity going on around their spaceport, getting ready. And there's Iranian media reports that Iran's getting ready to launch a satellite for the 41st anniversary of the Islamic Republic, which is a time they often try to come out with new technology and to unveil that. And then Iran's Minister of Information and Communication and Communications Technology, he confirmed they're preferring to launch their satellite system. So still more progress, progress seems the wrong word, regress or forward movement anyway towards their nuclear program, towards Iran having a bomb that it can put on a missile and use to destabilize the whole world. Meanwhile, Real Clear Defense linked to a couple of important pieces for the region where the general theme they show is America out, and they talk a fair bit about Russia coming in. Major General Amos Gilead, he's the executive director for the Institute for Policy and Strategy at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya near Tel Aviv in Israel. They had an article, or he had an article called "Geopolitics Abhors a Vacuum: Why America's Withdrawal from the Middle East and Russia's Rise May Make War Inevitable." And he talks about some of the bold moves America is taking in the Middle East right now. But he wrote, "Beneath the surface, I see a different U.S. policy taking shape. In the midst of these military responses, I am witnessing what seems to be a fighting retreat. Expect a strong U.S. response only when U.S. lives are lost or under imminent threat." And then he quotes the president's national security advisor saying, "The president said we want to be out of the Middle East, but what we need to do is leave on our own terms." I think it's a good way of putting it. It's a fighting retreat. There's still some boldness, and we saw that with America taking out Soleimani. But at the end of the day, they're looking to get out of that region. He goes on to write, "As the U.S. recedes, Russia advances. In the wake of the Soleimani drone strike, Russian President Vladimir Putin is crisscrossing the Middle East, meeting with Syrian strongman Bashar al-Assad, stopping in Ankara to broker a ceasefire in Libya. Nature, they say, abhors a vacuum. So too does geopolitics. And so Putin steps forwards as America steps back. Russia is running the show in northern Syria. Assad stands unchallenged, given a second life by Russian backing. Syria is now, if we speak freely, a protectorate with Russia, and he talks about how Russia wants a naval base within the Middle East there. He talks about how Russia is pushing its power outwards, how they're working with Egypt and Turkey, how some of the big decisions that are being taken that affect the Middle East are being taken without the United States. And he points out how dangerous this is for any democracy in the region to have Russia becoming this major power, Russia being the one calling the shots. And then Real Clear Politics, they also featured an article from the Lowly Institute's The Interpreter called "Russia Makes Its Presence Known in Iran Crisis." And that makes a really interesting point. It talks about how Well, it says Iran's bluntly open challenge to the US may have been backed by another major military power, Russia. And it talks about how Russia is probably giving Iran a lot of this satellited precision missile satellite guided technology that's allowing Iran's missiles to strike US bases. Russia, China, Iran, just last month in December, they held their first trilateral naval exercise, maritime security belt in the Indian Ocean, a crucial piece of geographic real estate. They talked about how when this whole crisis erupted between Iran and the US, Vladimir Putin quickly came to Syria, came to Turkey as well, visiting Bashar al-Assad, and then held large-scale naval exercises in the Black Sea. They wrote the timing and locale of the exercises was equally revealing. Russia was again showcasing its military might, including offensive firepower, as a warning to the US and its allies that it will not act as a passive observer should Iran come under attack. The article states Russian air defenses have been closely monitoring airspace over and around Iran and probably sharing intelligence with Tehran. On the 17th of January, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov stated that at least six fifth-generation F-35 tactical aircraft were spotted near Iranian airspace shortly after Iranian missile attack. So it seems like they're using all of their advanced technology to monitor what the American Air Force is doing and then passing that intelligence on to Iran. So Russia, they're really helping Iran. This article, I think, also had a good balance in pointing out why Russia is helping Iran. It says that Russia has not unconditionally taken the side of Iran. It talks about how Russia probably benefited from the death of Soleimani, as well as the United States. You know, that Soleimani is a terrorist leader. He had the potential to hurt Russia. These two powers do have some things in difference as well, some things where they don't get on. He writes that Iran is a partner of convenience for Moscow, not a close friend or a client. So, you know, these two will work together, but they're working together because Russia wants America out of the Middle East, because Russia wants to bring America down a peg or two, and because Iran also wants to see America brought down a peg or two, well, much more than that, and so the two of them are quite happy to work together, even though that they're at an odds in a whole load of other areas, and even though this alliance may well not last particularly long, but Russia, very anti-United States, and is very willing to help this terrorist-sponsoring nation attack the United States as well. So important events within the Middle East to watch for. You know, there's been these big events, and this area is still moving forwards in exactly the same way that we've been saying to watch for right since the start of the trumpet all the way back in 1991. You know, the big key trends that we're seeing in the Middle East, you know, they're evident, or that we've been saying to watch for, they're evident in all of those headlines. The rise of Iran. Iran spreading its influence. You know, Iran taking over Iraq. And we see Iraq now trying to fight back against that. But Iran's moving in there. Iranian-backed militia targeting the U.S. embassy. Iran moving towards a nuclear bomb. Iran, despite that setback of Soleimani being killed, working towards this missile technology that will enable them to have a nuclear missile. We see America retreating again, despite that aggressive action against Soleimani. Well, it's fighting, but it's a fighting retreat. They still want out of there. And then other powers moving in. Those articles focused on Russia. We've said watch for Europe. And we've said watch for Europe because the same prophecies that talk about the rise of Iran, those same prophecies that allowed Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry all the way back in 1991 to say, watch for Iran. Watch for Iran to conquer Iraq. You know, watch for that. Those same prophecies that told him that, they also said, well, Europe's going to be the one that confronts Iran. Europe is the one to watch in the region. They're going to get more involved as America retreats. So this whole area is, you know, everything that happens there, all those big pieces of news, they all tie right into that prophetic framework. And if that prophetic framework is new to you, you can read more about that in our free book, The King of the South. We're more than happy to send that to you. You can read it online at thetrumpet.com. Just go to the library tab at the top right there. And we'll also send you your own free print copy so that you can print it or have it on paper and read it yourself. And we'll post that to you for free as well. Well, one final point or story I'll talk about a little bit just before the break, because it does start to lead into our main story today. Mr. Flurry spoke about it a fair bit yesterday, so I won't spend too long, but we're seeing Mr. Trump now come closer to unveiling his peace deal in the Middle East. And Michael Oren was speaking about this, I think, over the weekend. He's the former Israeli ambassador to the United States. And I think he made a really good point talking about the response to this deal. So, you know, President Trump is putting forward this. It looks like it would be some kind of two-state solution. This is something he's been working for several years. And this in this clip, Mr. Oren is talking about how the Palestinians might respond to that. This is clip four.
Mr. Ambassador, appreciate your time, sir. 50% of this deal would be the Palestinians. They've already said no thanks, and we're not even bothering showing up either at the negotiating table or in Washington. What's the point?
But good to be with you, Leland. You know, the Palestinians hold the world record for people who have been offered peace, have been offered a two-state solution throughout history, and every time have said no. As a matter of fact, they don't even have yes in their vocabulary. So I think that the administration has internalized this. It's a new day, and this peace plan is aimed at really two customers, if you will, the Israeli public and the moderate Arab Sunni world, particularly the Gulf states. And so far, the reactions are very good.
So he talks about, well, the reactions are good, he says, from Israel and from the moderate Sunni world, at least the way he sees it, but not from the Palestinians. You know, they're not ever going to say yes to a peace deal. As Agency France Presse, they had an article. This is about a different terrorist group, not necessarily a Palestinian one, but they write, ISIS threatens Israel with new phase of attacks, marking shift in terror strategy. They wrote, Islamic State vowed to shift its focus from the remnant of its caliphate towards Israel in its first audio statement since confirming the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. In its purported audio message, its spokesman Abu Hamza al-Qurashi, the jihadist organization, called for sabotaging a so-called peace plan that U.S. President Donald Trump is due to unveil. It talks about how they want a new phase. And then they quote the spokesman saying, the eyes of the soldiers of the caliphate, wherever they are still on Jerusalem. So there's this peace plan on the table, but it's also important to remember there's still a whole lot of conflict coming around Jerusalem. It's not going to make these terrorist groups go away. They're still focused and they're talking about war with Jerusalem. The Palestinians are not going to accede to this peace deal. They never have done. There'll be more terrorism, more conflict around Jerusalem. Again, I don't want to rule out any kind of short-term resurgence, especially if you know, Mr. Trump comes in with this peace deal and also provides some measure of defense for Israel. But in the long run, these people are not going away. There's a huge hatred for Israel out there. And even within some of these, say, modern Sunni states that Mr. Oren talked about, a huge level of hatred for Israel. That's not going away anytime soon. So this peace deal is out there, but it's not all flowers and roses for Israel in at least the immediate future. But we'll talk more about that after the break. We'll have a quick break. Now, when we come back, we'll get into what was going on at Auschwitz yesterday with the commemorations for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz and the Holocaust Memorial Day.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe. And it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings?
What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. He is off visiting Jerusalem right now. And so we've got a few days of substitutes. Well, yesterday was Holocaust Memorial Day. It was the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz or Auschwitz-Birkenau, that infamous concentration camp. And world leaders gathered to meet there, to hold a ceremony there. We heard from several different world leaders. We also heard from some survivors of Auschwitz, of that concentration camp and of the Holocaust. And they gave a really powerful warning to those assembled, to the next generation especially, that warning was focused on. One in particular, he addressed his grandchildren, his grandchildren's friends, his grandchildren's generation. And it was a really powerful and really sobering warning that they gave. So we'll get into that just shortly. We'll get into some of the quotes that we heard from them. But I'll just give you some background first about Auschwitz. There are 1.1 million people, 1.1 million murdered in this death camp alone, which is a stunning figure. History Extra is a website maintained by the BBC. They said that Auschwitz is the site of the largest single mass murder in the history of the world. Boston Globe pointed out that this figure, 1.1 million that were murdered at this site, that's more than the combined US death toll in every war and every military operation in the last 155 years. So they wrote, tally every American killed in the Spanish-American War, World Wars I and II, the Korean War, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the total comes to less than the number of Jews murdered in Auschwitz, which is just a stunning figure. And then as they go on to point out, the number murdered in Auschwitz is just a fraction of the total number of Jews murdered throughout that war. Just an absolutely shocking crime. History Extra, going back to this article, they had a brief history of what went on there, and they write that they go through some of that history. They talk about how Auschwitz was originally designed to strike terror into the hearts of these indigenous Poles. So it was originally, when they very first built it, it was designed to terrorize the Poles. If they caused any trouble for the Germans or even looked as if they might cause trouble, they risked being shipped to Auschwitz. The first prisoners arrived in June 1940, and until 1942, the vast majority of inmates at the camp were Polish political prisoners. Though this was not yet a place of mass extermination, they write, huge numbers of these Poles perished in the camp from various kinds of ill-treatment, including starvation, beating, and execution. So much so that more than half of the 23,000 Poles first sent to Auschwitz were dead within 20 months. It then went through how that transition to being Soviet prisoners. And then from 1942 onwards, 1942, they began sending Jews to the Auschwitz camp and to the Birkenau camp that they built just next door. 1943, they built they call them killing factories, the BBC History did. But these purpose-built buildings to kill people as efficiently as possible. You know, they were working there even before they built these factories. So they turned all the tools of science and scientific inquiry to look at, well, how can we kill people as quickly and as efficiently as possible? And they came up with Zyklon B gas. Because it was industrialized murder. Dr. Joseph Mengele was stationed there as well, who conducted so-called experiments on the victims and on children. He'd take twins and do tests on them, tests that they wouldn't survive very long. A BBC History article wrote, this was mechanized extermination, the likes of which the world had never seen, organized by people from a cultured nation at the heart of Europe who knew exactly what they were doing. the article talked about Rudolf Hess, the man who ran the camp, you know, how cruel he was, what he did to people, personally overseeing the murder of over a million people. But it talked about how one of the things that stood out about Rudolf Hess wasn't that he was some kind of cartoonish villain. Instead, they talk about one lawyer who interviewed him after the war. And they talked about how his demeanor, the way he acted, he seemed like a normal person, like a grocery clerk, this lawyer said. He just seemed like a normal person, but he was the one overseeing this camp with such cruelty. I think this is from that same article. It says the camp's orchestra, well, it talks about, no, this is from a somebody who was there talking about their recollection. One of the things that stood out to them, watching their guards, watching the people that were doing all of this murdering. And he said, the camp's orchestra was playing masterpieces by German, Austrian, and Italian composers. SS men were sitting by the crematorium where children, mothers, women, and men were burning, but they were just sitting there. Now I think that they were pleased to have properly completed their work and were due for a cultural entertainment. They had no dilemmas. The wind from Birkenau blew the smoke from the death camp. Through the smoke from the death camp in, but they were just sitting and listening to Mozart and others. This is what a human being is capable of. And they were just there listening to Mozart while murdering a million. And so this is what world leaders were there remembering. And to the credit of them, those getting up speaking, they gave those world leaders quite a witness about what happened there, but also about, you know, where they see the world is coming. Ronald S. Lauder, he's the chair of the World Jewish Congress, and he gave one of the speeches there. And he talked about how many died at this camp, how many participated in the murder of the in the murders that went on here, how these were seemingly ordinary, cultured, advanced, scientific individuals, and then just how many around the world either allowed that or turned a blind eye to what happened there. Here's what he said. This is clip two.
We have all wondered how an advanced country that gave the world great literature and art, science, achievement, could sink to an anger, a meanness, a depravity like Auschwitz. But let me be clear. While Germany and Austria cause created and carry out this shattering evil, practically every other European country helped the Nazis gather up their Jewish citizens. Too many people in too many countries made Auschwitz happen. When European Jews begged the world for a safe harbor, somewhere to go, the entire world turned its back on them. Even my own country, the beacon of freedom, turned out its light on the Jewish people when they needed it most.
So a massive worldwide problem. And country, you know, advanced countries, scientific countries, countries that you would expect to be lights to the world, you know, leaders of the world, ended up leading the world in mass extermination. But one of the things that really came up at this commemoration yesterday was just how many are ignorant of this history and how we're repeating this history. The Associated Press, they had an article last week just on the upcoming commemorations talking about, well, with some statistics. They talked about a survey that was released by the Claims Conference, a Jewish organization that, well, they go and they try to get compensation claims from Nazi victims. They found that most people in France did not know that 6 million Jews were killed during World War II. They said among millennials, 45% said they were unaware of French collaboration with the Nazi regime. And the article says, well, the French wartime government deported 76,000 Jews to the death camps. But 45% of millennials, nearly half. And millennials, that's not just, you know, that doesn't really refer to teens. You know, that's talking about people in their 20s and their 30s that have finished school, finished education, and they still don't know the facts about what went on. 45% thinking, well, you know, France didn't have anything to do with that. We didn't have anything to do with it. But, well, Tel Aviv University, they had, this is from that same AP article, they talked about how researchers found that attacks against Jews grew significantly in 2018. The largest number of Jews killed in anti-Semitic attacks in decades. 400 attacks they recorded. And you know where they found the biggest spike in attacks, the biggest increase in anti-Semitic attacks? In Western Europe. In Western Europe, right where this happened before. AP wrote, the research also noted increased anti-Semitic vitriol online and in newspapers as extremist political parties grew in power in several countries. It's coming back. We're seeing this again more and more. And this is something that Mr. Lauder, the head of the World Jewish Congress, talked about at his speech. This is clip one.
5 years ago, at the 70th anniversary, I was very concerned about the shocking rise of anti-Semitism here in Europe. Today, you all know the attacks on Jews, the killings, the vicious slanders have only grown worse, and they have spread to my own country. 75 years ago, when the world finally saw the pictures of the gas chambers here and the piles of bodies, nobody in their right mind wanted to be associated with the Nazis. But now, I see something I never thought I would see in my lifetime. The open and brazen spread of anti-Jewish hatred throughout the world once again. In 2020, we hear the same lies the Nazis used so effectively in their propaganda. They said, Jews have too much power. Jews control the economy and the media. Jews control governments. Jews control everything. We hear this madness online, in the media, and even within democratic governments. We will never eradicate anti-Semitism. It's a deadly virus that's been with us for over 2,000 years. But we cannot look the other way and pretend that it doesn't happen. That's what people did throughout the 1930s. And that is what led to Auschwitz.
We thought we would never be here and never be in this situation. Never see some of the things that we're seeing, at least never again. But they're seeing that rise in anti-Semitism. Marian Tusky, he was a Polish-Jewish survivor. And he gave a speech there as well. He was the one I mentioned that he focused addressing the younger generation, the generation of his grandchildren or his granddaughter. And he went through some of that history. He said, well, it started out with the signs being carved on park benches. You know, Jews can't sit here. And then, well, Jews can't shop here. And Jewish children can't play with Aryan children. And he went through all of those steps and talked about how, well, what began with banning Jews from sitting on benches, it gradually became, and eventually became, well, sending Jews to ghettos, sending Jews to death camps. He was quoting, I think, the Austrian president, Alexander von der Bellen, but he said, Auschwitz did not fall from the sky. And then he told those, well, don't be indifferent. He talked about how young people, polls have shown that significant numbers of young people are bored by the Holocaust, bored by studying this history. And he said to them, he told them not to be indifferent. He said, because if you are indifferent, you will not even notice it when upon your own heads and upon the heads of your descendants, another Auschwitz descends from the sky. You know, this didn't come out of nowhere, he was saying. And the same signs that led up to Auschwitz, well, he said, I can see those same signs now. And people are indifferent to it. And if you're bored by this history or if you're indifferent to what happened, well, we're just going to repeat it. Alberto Israel, he gave an interview on Sky News. He made a similar point talking about what went on here. This is clip five.
Nous sommes maintenant, je vois parfois la même chose qu'en 1933. Les mêmes manifestations, les mêmes choses qui courent, les mêmes méchancetés, les mêmes insultes, la même chose. Oui, ça a changé les personnes, c'est le même. C'est très mauvais.
Well, I made the mistake there of asking asking our producers to get that clip without having looked at it myself. And nobody told me it wasn't in English. I mean, it's still, if you saw the video, you would have seen the translations, the subtitles there. He was talking about, well, it's the same people, it's the same thing. I didn't bring a transcript of exactly what he said there. But you know, he's saying we're seeing the same thing that we saw in the 30s, the same attitudes. The same direction. I mean, just, you see this in the news every day. This is just from one from Deutsche Welle. There was a story that I saw this morning talking about how we're repeating some of this history. And this was, they were talking about the rise in far right extremism within the German military. There we go. The title's New Figures on Extremism in Germany's Military. Tip of the Iceberg. It's just the tip of the iceberg. It talks about how Germany's top military intelligence agency saw a 30% increase in suspected extremism within the German military. And they write, analysts say the figures indicate a deeper problem. The article states, Germany's top military intelligence agency is currently investigating over 500 cases of suspected right-wing extremism within the country's armed forces, the Bundeswehr. That number makes an uptick of 30% from the previous year. But it said, those figures are just the tip of the iceberg, Caroline Walter, co-author of Extreme Security, a book on right-wing extremism within Germany's military and its law enforcement, told Deutsche Welle. The problem in the Bundeswehr is that whoever points out right-wing extremism, well, basically that they just don't want to even talk about the problem, and that if you talk about it, you're kind of a traitor to the military. They talk about how there was a case in 2017 of a German soldier who reportedly posed as a Syrian refugee to try and infiltrate the migrant community and carry out a terrorist attack. But it talks about how they've still got this problem there. You see it internationally as well. I did like the way that going back to Mr. Lauder and his speech there, you know, giving this speech while so many world leaders were there, you know, he called them out as well. He called world leaders out on their anti-Semitism, the anti-Semitism that you see on display all the time in the United Nations. Here's what he had to say about that. This is clip three.
75 years ago, the Jewish people left Auschwitz. They fled Europe. They were forced out of every country in the Middle East. And instead of living in refugee camps and turning to terror, they built a vibrant democracy in a place where democracy does not exist. They have created miracle after miracle while having to defend their existence every single day. No other country on earth has had to do this. And for this, the UN, some journalists, even some government leaders constantly condemn it. But it's even worse. Israel has been singled out over and over again with the same lies that we heard about the Jewish people for centuries. Over the last 7 years alone, the United Nations General Assembly has adopted 202 resolutions condemning countries around the world. Of those 202 resolutions, Israel was condemned 163 times, and the rest of the world only 39. 163 against Israel, 39 for the rest of the world. We all know these votes are absurd. The UN ignores true evil dictatorships that kill millions of their own people. And it's clear as day that this kind of obsessive anti-Zionism is nothing but anti-Semitism.
I mean, he's right. If you were to judge by the UN, the biggest problem nation in the world would be Israel. And the fact that so many countries keep voting that way, I think, shows you a global level of dangerous anti-Semitism. The nations are willing to target Israel like that repeatedly. I mean, it's crazy. I don't know any way of justifying that kind of, what, like 70-80% of UN resolutions taken against Israel, whatever those figures that he gave. And you know, not Iran, not Russia, not these countries that, or not China, where they're literally locking people into concentration camps. You know, they're not the ones that we single out. It's Israel. You've got this international community that in so many ways is fundamentally anti-Semitic. And like I said, I did like the way he drew attention to that when there were all those world leaders sitting in the audience and they're all, you know, doing their best to look somber and nodding along and things like that when they're part of the problem. And he quite rightly pointed that out to them. This was a shocking story. This was on our website yesterday. The story is called, Is It Murder If You Kill a Jew? This one shocking story from Europe, from France. You may recall the story of Sarah Halami. So she was a Jew. She was beaten to death in 2017. The story shocked France. It shocked the world. It made headlines all around the world. She was beaten to death by her Muslim neighbor, Kabali Traore, I guess his name was. He shouted Allahu Akbar as he killed her. But last month, the judge ruled that Traore was not guilty of murder. So he killed this Jew, but he's not guilty of murder. In the run-up to the attack, he subjected Halami, this woman that he eventually killed, with verbal abuse, shouting at her, insulting at her because she's Jewish. He said that the Jewish candelabra and the Hebrew prayer book in Halami's apartment enraged him. And for any other minority in the world, a hate crime becomes worse. The punishments get heavier if it's motivated by hate. If you've got an attack that is motivated by racism, then the penalties usually applied by law increase from just a, quote-unquote normal attack. But not when the target's a Jew. Here, the judge said he was not guilty of murder on the grounds that he was criminally irresponsible of his actions because he was not aware that his drug abuse was driving him crazy. So he didn't know, apparently, that taking drugs isn't good for you and can be bad for your mind. And so therefore, because he didn't know this, and then he went on to kill a Jew, he's not guilty of murder. He's not responsible for his actions. And this ruling naturally caused an uproar in the Jewish community. And you've got this comes at a time where anti-Semitic attacks are increasing, like we already said. Jews, they comprise about 1% of the population in France, and suffer more than half of the racist attacks. This huge figure. Following Traoré's acquittal, or at least being found not guilty of murder, France's chief rabbi, he wrote a letter to the Minister of Justice saying that the decision was a license to kill the Jews. That's what France's chief rabbi is warning. Right now, France's chief rabbi is writing to the Justice Minister saying, you're giving people a license to kill Jews. That's where we are at the moment. His brother, Halami's brother, or her brother, he said that there's a willing blindness on behalf of the French authorities to see and do justice. Gavin Mortimer, he called attention to this in The Spectator. I think it was last week. He said it says that this ruling reinforces the belief among some that they are being abandoned by a government more interested in appeasing the country's Islamists. So they'll turn a blind eye to the persecution of the Jews because they want to appease some of these radical anti-Jewish Muslims. He talked about how you had several leading figures on the French left. They came with a quote-unquote stop Islamophobia march where people were shouting Allahu Akbar, and how the left is not helping the situation because they're siding with radical Islam in too many cases. In this article, he also talked about one woman who whose son was beaten up by a gang of thugs and 50 other people just stood watching. And people shouting things like, well, shame it's not Gaza, so we could exterminate the Jews. So you see, this increase in anti-Semitic attacks look like. And so we're getting this powerful warning from those that saw it last time, that lived through it, that lived through the horrors of it. And they talked about, you know, the massive scars that it left, you know, seeing their family members killed, seeing all their friends killed. In so many cases, those people speaking yesterday were the only ones that survived of their families. And they're up there saying, well, it could happen again. And it is happening again. We're seeing us going down the same path. And it's a powerful warning. It's an essential warning. And it's so easy to think, well, you know, they were barbarians, but we're civilized. It couldn't happen now. And we appreciate art. We have all this science and technology. We're so advanced now. We appreciate Mozart and Beethoven and fine culture. You know, even without meaning to, I think we can look back and kind of see the people that did this as almost like a separate species that is gone forever. But those people up there speaking at the commemoration, well, they were providing that connection with the past, making it real for world leaders, making it real for those that tuned in, and sounding that warning. I've got some more statistics here on how anti-Semitic parties are growing, how you have the Alternative for Deutschland in some parts of Germany is the most popular party, and they've criticized Germany for remembering the Holocaust, for building Holocaust memorials. They've had one of their leaders talked about how Germany should be proud of the accomplishments of its soldiers in World War II. And then you've got that in other countries. We've got Jobbik, the second largest the second most popular political party in Poland, routinely engaged in anti-Semitism. You've got polls showing rising anti-Semitism, 24% in Hungary saying they want Jews to leave the country, up from 12% in 2006. 30% want restrictions on the number of Jews who can work in certain jobs. You had Austria's Freedom Party until recently was part of the Austrian government that was founded by two former members of the Waffen-SS. You have high levels of anti-Semitism in the Yellow Vest movement in France. 44% saying that they believe there was a global Zionist plot. In the UK, you had the Labour Party that could have won the election back in December under investigation. You know, the BBC had a panorama program asking, is Labour anti-Semitic? With an hour-long expose with Jewish Labour members talking about the barrage of persecution they'd received since Jeremy Corbyn took over that party. And the way that party leaders had protected anti-Semites. You know, you had The Guardian, one of the big mainstream newspapers in Britain, having an editorial, not some kind of fringe columnist, but an editorial saying, I can't remember the exact words, but I'm paraphrasing, well, you know, it's not good that Jeremy Corbyn is anti-Semitic or that there's these anti-Semitism problems within the Labour Party. But Labour's still the best hope for the left in Britain, and therefore we should vote for it. The anti-Semitism is not really important. It's not a big deal. We can ignore that. That's what they were saying. And then you see people forgetting that history. Like I said, those leaders were speaking directly to the younger generation that were forgetting that history. A CNN poll in November, they studied, this was November 2018, but they studied 7,000 people. 7,000, more than a third, said they knew little to nothing about violence against Jews in World War II. 5% never heard of the Holocaust. In France, that figure was 20% among 18 to 34-year-olds. One in five 18 to 34-year-olds, you know, didn't just not know what happened or a bit fuzzy on the details of the Holocaust. They'd never heard of it. And so Jews are worried. December 2018 poll from the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights. 89% of Jews said anti-Semitism had increased significantly over the last 5 years. 38% said they were thinking of leaving because they no longer feel safe. Nathan Sharansky, former president of the Jewish Agency for Israel, he warned there was no future for Jews in France. And when you see stories like the one we talked about, well, you can see why. Jewish People's Policy Institute, they forecast in 2015 that they expected 250,000 Jews to move from France to Israel. And there's currently only about 500,000 there. So they're expecting a mass migration. And this is a story that's disturbing. Obviously, it's disturbing for Jews. It's disturbing for all of us. Throughout history, you've had this connection between anti-Semitism and a society in crisis. It's a symptom of society in crisis. The Guardian's Jonathan Friedland, he had an article in 2018. He said, Jews have often functioned as a canary in the coal mine. When a society turns on its Jews, it is usually a sign of wider ill health. You know, it's no coincidence that you had the world's worst ever attack on Jews with Auschwitz and things like that being built at the same time as, number-wise, the world's most destructive war. And you see this, you know, as Russia fell apart, as the Russian Empire fell apart before the Communist Revolution, and you had a series of pogroms against Jews. As France had problems in the late 19th century, you saw the anti-Dreyfus or the Dreyfus Affair and anti-Semitism there. You going back longer, you know, the Black Death hits Europe, persecute the Jews. Whenever these are these big social tensions, that's what happens. Whenever Europe gets involved in the Middle East, you see it as well. You know, side by side with the Crusades, there would be anti-Semitic attacks. Now, during the First Crusade, you had a separate German crusade that wiped out Jews in Central Europe. And there's a whole host of other examples there as Europe gets more involved in the Middle East. But I want to talk about, in this last few minutes, some of the spiritual reality behind these anti-Semitic attacks. Because, you know, I don't like talking about this subject. There was such a powerful warning yesterday, I kind of felt like I had to. But when we get to the spiritual reality, well, that's where the hope lies as well. I mean, you heard the chairman there of the, was it Lauda, of the World Jewish Congress saying, well, we're never going to get rid of the scourge of anti-Semitism. Well, no, there is hope. That scourge of anti-Semitism, there is a time where that will be destroyed. But we have to understand that spiritual reality to understand that hope. Now, the Bible, if you believe the Bible, you have to believe that there is a devil who hates God, who seeks to destroy him. You know, Revelation 12 talks about that. John 8:44, Jesus Christ himself confirms there is a devil. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. Ephesians 2 and verse 2 talks about the devil influencing people's moods and feelings and emotions. In his Key of David booklet, trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory wrote, Satan can stir up vicious hatred. He loves to use out-of-control emotion. A religion taken to the extreme, such as radical Islam, gives him a great field to work in. Nazi Germany exhibited fanatical hatred for the Jews. The Nazis also used emotion to stir up a repugnant hatred. The coming beast power will exhibit the same hatred of the Jews as well. Most people who hate the Jews don't even know why they do, he said. Can we see Satan behind such lies and hatred? So that's the spiritual reality. But why the special hatred? Well, it's because the Jews have a special role in God's plan. Mr. Flory writes, Satan, the devil, understands the plan of God. He has a great hatred for God. Because of the plan of God, the word Jew can really stir up Satan's wrath. Hatred for the Jews has been inspired by Satan. Now, that's why anti-Semitism is such an effective barometer of crisis. It shows when Satan is really influencing minds. And you look at the rise in anti-Semitism and you can really see the rise of Satan's influence in the world reflected in that. But there's great hope in God's plan for the Jews. And that's why Satan hates them. I'm not going to be able to get into that in too much detail in the 2 minutes or so that I have left. But you can go through the Bible, you can see that there are promises that the Messiah would be born to a Jewish woman. You know, that's a great honor for the Jews there. And Mr. Flory wrote in that book, well, God directly involved the Jews in his plan. From these facts, we must assume that God the Father and Jesus Christ have a close connection to the Jewish race, but only to further their spiritual plan. So they have a close connection. The Jews were committed the oracles of God, Paul writes in Romans 3 and verse 2. They preserved the Sabbath. They preserved God's calendar. They preserved the many writings and revelations and the law. You know, God used the Jews to preserve these for the whole world. Satan hates the law. He hates God's plan. There's a throne that was given to Judah that Genesis talks about, a scepter. Genesis 49 talks about that God used the Jews to prepare to preserve. A throne that's going to bring unity and peace to the whole world. So God has a wonderful plan, and for mankind. That plan involves the Jews, and so Satan hates that, and he directly attacks that plan, and he directly attacks that Jews. But when we understand this plan, well, that does give us great hope, and it does point to a time where Jesus Christ is going to intervene in world affairs, and anti-Semitism will be over, will be done for good. You know, the news that we saw from Auschwitz yesterday, it is a reality check in the evil of the world that we live in and what's coming. But we can also know that we're at close to a time when that evil will be gone for good. I have an article on our Trumpet website that you can read that talks about the one minority people love to hate, that it's called. You can go and read more about the spiritual reality of anti-Semitism there. The Key of David booklet by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory. There's a chapter in there that's a great place to go to read more on anti-Semitism. I'd really encourage you to go and to read that. Well, that's about it from me. You can keep coming back. You can get all of that literature at thetrumpet.com. You can email if you have any feedback at td@kpcg.fm. Well, thanks for listening, and please do tune back in tomorrow here at the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on kpcg.fm.